This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum. Now, are we ready?
Yeah.
Facebook Live?
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thanks for coming out to Wednesday Night Live. This is kind of a new series that I'm starting, the Raising Kids in a Me Too World, and it's always been a Me Too world. So today's title, the topic we're going to talk about is developing a child's identity to prevent, expose, and heal trauma. First of all, I want to introduce myself, Matt Long. That's really all that matters. Now, I thought about doing a bio or talking about my background, and I'll do it for a minute. I am an attorney who's been practicing law for about 15 years now. Most of my practice has been in criminal law with an emphasis of special victims types crimes. But the reality is my background, the number of years that I've practiced law, the type of work that I've done, the trainings that I've been on or have gone through, the types of cases that I've handled, maybe not be irrelevant, but it's not the thing that I want to emphasize. Because too often people want to hold out their resume, their curriculum vitae, as the reason why you should listen to somebody. And that's not why I hope you get something out of what I talk about today. I hope the things that I'm going to be talking about are going to speak for themselves, and that it's going to be something that everyone can apply and at least understand to hopefully help them or maybe help somebody that they love. So before I get into, I guess, the meat of the topic, I want to talk about a philosophy of mine and a philosophy that I'd like to govern these conversations. Let's call it a creed, if you will, a dogma. And my philosophy, or this creed or dogma, is there are no creeds and no dogmas. Follow your intuition, okay? And be connected with other people. Those are generally the philosophy that I want to follow and want to have you follow as we're talking about the things we're going to be talking about today and in coming weeks. And the reason why is because, especially when we're talking about abuse and trauma, every person is individualized. And every person, I think, is better equipped to know what's right for them. I'm very much opposed to there being gurus or shaman or life coaches or prophets. I have a lot of my own trauma in following would-be prophets over my life. So as a result of that, I don't pretend to step up and say, you should listen to me. Rather, I hope to take on the role not of as an attorney, but of an educator, a teacher. A teacher that can hopefully awaken some things, give you some understandings about some concepts and principles that are important to have you apply those into your own life. So that's a general framework for, I guess, the rules, the non-rules of what I want to follow, and I'm going to ask you all to adopt and apply as we're talking. The other thing kind of related to this is the idea of the perfect not being the enemy of the good. Now, I've spent a lot of time over the last 10 years training and teaching law enforcement, other attorneys, and other professionals that work with children. And every time I present, I emphasize this thing, this idea of the perfect not being the enemy of the good. What I mean by that is I'm going to be talking about a framework. I'm going to be talking about some generalities. There may be some exceptions that don't fit into the framework. That's okay. If it doesn't apply, reject it. Again, that goes back to there not being creeds, not being dogmas. If it seems to work, if it seems to make sense to you, then apply it. Okay? The other thing I want everybody to be comfortable is to challenge me on some ideas. As I said, I'm not claiming any sort of authority that you must listen to, but hopefully it'll provide, again, some framework, some concepts that will make sense, that will ring true to each of you. So that's the philosophy, that's the framework, that's kind of the setup to what I want to talk about. So the concepts associated with, the other thing is, I'm working without a net, no notes, no PowerPoint, okay? So as part of the perfect not being of the enemy of the good, allow me to be imperfect with the things I might say. I might misspeak. I might just get things completely wrong. That could happen. So as I say things, feel free to question what I'm saying and give me a pass as well. I do have some other professionals that I'm going to be bouncing some of this stuff off. If I do get something wrong or misspeak, I'm fairly confident that they'll be quick to correct me on it, and then we'll come back and correct information, hopefully, if that becomes necessary. Okay. So one of the main frameworks that I'm going to be talking about, and going to be referring to over and over again, it's a concept called victimology. Victimology is a legal term. It's something that we deal with in court all the time, talking about the cycle of abuse is another way to put it. What it comes from is Roland Summit, is this dude, this psychologist, I think. There's me for research, right? Who came up back in the 80s with this model, this educational model called Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome. Roland Summit, Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome. Syndrome, that's a heavy word. And probably in retrospect, not the best term that he could have used, that maybe he should have used, because it's caused a lot of misunderstanding and confusion about the information he was presenting. Because a lot of people took that these concepts and thought that it's a diagnosis. And there's been a lot of problems with trying to use that as a diagnosis and looking at a kid and saying, well, if these things exist, then we can know that kid was abused. And Roland Summit himself said, that is not how we apply this. That is not the purpose of the things that I'm doing. But instead, the purpose was to explain the real world of sexual abuse, the real world of what kids go through and why they respond in certain ways that they do. So I'm going to be borrowing from that. A lot of things that I'm going to be talking about are related to that. But also, an application of that in court is this idea of victimology. And victimology is very much related to Roland Summit's CSAA, CSAAS, right? Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome that he presented. And victimology is this. It's the idea that there is a selection or a target phase of abuse. That is, the offender is trying to select and target a particular kid. There's an engagement phase. The offender engages, gains the trust of the kid and all those people who are in the circle of influence of that kid. Now, I'm going to be talking about kids. Obviously, perfect not being the enemy of the good, no creeds. This can be applicable to adult situations and cross-gender situations. Again, we'll get into some of those topics down the road, but when I talk about kid, I'm talking about victim, okay? Genderless at this point. When I talk about kid, in some cases, I might be talking about an adult who's responding like a kid, right? Engagement, gaining the trust of a child and all those around the child. Grooming, breaking down the physical barriers of a child. The assault, the offense itself. And then concealment, make the kid not talk, okay? Now, too often we do this as a cycle. There's a visual that I do that makes it look like it flows one to the other. That's not how it works. These phases are fluid. They go in and out and in and out. And we're gonna get into some specifics as we move down the road here, as we get into topics, because the things that we're going to be talking about are extremely dense. There's a lot of dynamics at play here. And so instead of trying to do it all at once, we're going to take little 45-minute chunks every other Wednesday and get into hopefully a very concrete and practical piece. If I do it right, we're not just going to be talking about sexual abuse or about abuse generally. We might just be talking about a human condition. Because a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about are issues that we just deal with in our culture, in our society, and as it relates to kids. Okay? So that's generally the framework that we're going to be talking about, that I'm going to be referring to. And it's a resource that you can look at, Roland Summit, Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome. It's worthwhile looking on your own. It's available on the interwebs in PDF. And if anyone wants access to that, I can put it up on our website and make that available as well. Look, there's some controversy around Roland Summit stuff. At some point, I'm going to have a specific presentation about that and its application in the court. But the reality is, we're not here to talk about the court system. We're not here to talk about beyond a reasonable doubt rules of evidence. Instead, we're here to talk about what the real world of abuse looks like. Now, a lot of people talk about start by believing. And I just happen to not be a start by believing guy. And that's controversial. At some point, I do want to do a specific presentation in the Start By Believing program. Because there is a specific program called Start By Believing that's been adopted by agencies throughout the country, and there are some issues associated with it. When somebody comes to me, and this happens a lot, and they disclose that they've been sexually abused, I believe that person experienced that. And so I'm not going to start by disbelieving. I'm not going to start by questioning and peppering them with questions. Well, prove it. But that doesn't mean I'm going to just take everything they say without evaluating it through the filter and the lens of my experience and my training. So that's, I guess, a prerogative that I have. But I bring it up because rather than starting by believing, what I want to try to do is start by looking at what the real world of abuse looks like. And then maybe if we can understand that from an educational standpoint, then we can apply other people's situations to what that real world of abuse looks like and have a greater understanding about what that person went through, have a greater understanding of what maybe loved ones went through, and have a greater understanding of what we went through. My goal here is to, again, be an educator, to try to educate people on the real world of abuse. That hopefully by a little bit of education, it just might help them, well, forgive themselves and forgive their loved ones for things that they had no control over. So I'm going to get into that here in a minute. I want to go back to my philosophy, the idea of there not being creeds, no dogmas, okay? There's not going to be specific rules. There's not just going to be one way. There's going to be a framework. Follow your intuition. I've said it another way, which is trust yourself. I've said it another way, which is to love yourself. And that's part of what we're going to be talking about today, and how to develop a child's identity to help prevent, expose, and heal from abuse, from trauma. But I hope that some of the things I'm going to be talking about today is going to help anybody who might hear it or anybody who might have kids love themselves, trust themselves, and help their kids to love themselves and trust themselves. So, here we go. Got to go to the notes. Now, in understanding, I guess, kids, and in understanding, some of the characteristics that make a kid particularly vulnerable to abuse, we have to understand the different types of offenders. Now, again, no creeds, no dogmas. This is not going to be an exhaustive list. But too often, we have a particular idea of what an offender is, what an offender looks like, and what an offender does. And we try to apply a creed, a dogma, to an offender and say, all offenders look like this. And when we do that, we've just lost so much of the game. We've lost so much of the power, so much of truth, because we focused on what might be a myth and lost sight of a lot of the dangers that are right in front of us. So in talking about just these topics throughout as long as we'll be doing it, I'm really going to be talking about the myths of sexual abuse as well. And this is a presentation that I've done to law enforcement and other professionals for a number of times, for over 10 years, to talk about what the myths are. And one of the myths is, you know an offender just by the way they look. Now, I've been in court a number of times, especially as a prosecutor, and I see the person that's been charged that I'm looking to, to convict or to that's been charged, and he comes out of court, and there's every once in a while it happens, you say, yes, they just have that look, right? Now, I could give a look, but then it's going to offend people who don't fit into that category that might have a similar look. I was telling friends of mine the other day that, I always look for dolphin shorts as kind of the uniform of the flasher. This kind of is a joke, right? So if you wear dolphin shorts, that doesn't mean you're a flasher, but it doesn't mean you're not one either, I guess. The windowless van, we all want to spot those and avoid that. But the offenders are our teachers, our coaches, our preachers, dads, uncles, brothers, moms, their loved ones, right? There are other types of offenders. And the reason why I'm going to put this up again is to think about, in each type, what might make a child vulnerable to abuse. Okay? Let me see here. All right. So the first term I'm going to use, I want to debunk, is pedophile. This is a psychological concept, right? This is a misused term. Pedophile is somebody who only has sexual interest in prepubescent children. The vast majority of offenders are not pedophiles. Now, it may be a difference without a distinction. It may not matter. But I think too often when we overshoot and we try to overemphasize what an offender is, we misunderstand what the real world looks like. So, sure, there may be some that are predators. That's the other term you hear. They're all predators. I think that brings up a concept that, again, just it may be true in some circumstances, but isn't in all. The guy who's going to, here's the other thing, I'm always say guy when I refer to offender, that's just generally a pretty good generality to use. Females are offenders, certainly, and we'll have a conversation specifically about the female offender at some point. But when I say guy, please, that's why I say it. But that presumes this guy who's just on the prowl, looking for every opportunity, every chance to snatch a kid, abuse a kid, do something. And I think when we look at that type of a demon, that type of a boogeyman, it's just that. It's a boogeyman that may exist in some situations, but probably isn't the most common situation that we have to prevent against and worry about. Okay? It would be easier, I think, if the world existed where every offender was a predator type. We could spot them quicker. We could prevent them more. And I think a lot of times that's what our criminal justice system, probation departments, have that mindset to give us, maybe some cases, a false sense of safety, a false sense of security. Okay? But there are other types. You have the opportunistic offender, person who's looking for that opportunity. all types of different situations there. You have what I refer to as the breeder. These are scary guys. I've seen a number of them in my career, which are guys who get married, and when they're going to have a kid, when their wife is pregnant, their intent is to abuse that child. It's happened. It's rare, but it's happened. Okay? You have the guy who marries or dates the single mom in order to target the child. Happens. This brings up issues of appropriate relationships in dating and in a divorce situation. This is complicated stuff. It's not fun stuff to think about and worry about, especially if you're in a divorce situation, seeing dating and being concerned with that. But it's good to be aware. Have to be aware. General guidelines, some advice that I give people when they ask me is, I'm always cautious when the guy who's dating starts courting the child. And they do it under the guise of, hey, I want to be in their life. I want them to trust me. I want them to know I'm safe. And so I'm going to engage that child during dating or early on in marriage. Again, no creeds, no dogmas. It's just a general rule, something to be aware of. I say instead, let that relationship happen naturally. Let that child eventually develop that relationship. It's, again, complicated, difficult waters to navigate. But it's again, something to consider. Other types, you got the internet guys, right? How to Catch a Predator. You got a couple different categories here. You've got the true predator, the guy who's acting and pretending to be a juvenile, and then, you know, kind of changes. Or you've got the adult who's specifically targeting the kid. But then you also have another class. You have the guy who's trying to get a prostitute overage. And it turns out that it's a sting operation by police, where initially they say, I'm a 19-year-old prostitute. After making the deal, the cop comes back and says, actually, I'm 16 or 17. The guy says, okay, I'll continue on. They snatch him up. Pretty different class of risks associated there with the internet guys, but a lot of times they get lumped in as the same, kind of the same offender. Okay, again, we're going to be talking about computer issues again down the road, but anyway, the other one we have is family members, the most common. These are the ones who are naturally have that built-in trust, naturally have built-in access. Okay, all your range of family members, and you have your coaches, teachers, any other person that might have a natural trust interaction with a kid. The other one we have is the stranger danger. This is one where I think, again, we spend maybe an inordinate amount of time talking about, because it's the most scary. Maybe because it's the most, in some people's mind, it's the most preventable. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's certainly the most scary. Because something you'll hear me say over and over again is the greater the engagement that an offender has on a kid, the less likely that kid is to tell. The more trust that offender can have on a child, the less likely they are to tell. And with stranger danger, you have no engagement, you have no trust. So the way to keep them quiet is by homicide. That's why it's scary. It's why we should be worried about it and concerned about it. But focusing only on stranger danger and overlooking the most common issues of abuse, I think is problematic, because that's not how the real world of abuse looks like. So if you look at just that fairly limited class of offender that I'm talking about, there's, a couple things that I think make a child particularly vulnerable. And at some point we are going to talk about some characteristics, but not today. Today I want to talk about the things that make a child the most vulnerable are essentially two from my perspective. This is the word according to Matt, I guess, is access, number one. They have to have access to these kids in order to go through the engagement, grooming, assault, concealment process, right? Access. The second characteristic that makes a kid particularly vulnerable is the kid they believe just won't tell. Access is hard to control for. You can't lock your kid up in a room, say you will never have access to any male figure in your life, teacher, coach, music, math teacher, all these things, right? That's challenging. But I think we can give our kids some tools so that they're less likely to be the kid that won't tell. Let's see. So as I talk about these things, I want to come back to that idea of no creeds, no dogmas, follow your intuition. The reason why I want to come back to that is because as I'm going to be talking about some things, it might trigger some realizations that, man, I could have done better. For some people, it might be, maybe I failed my kid in these regards. And I don't want people to have that, because parents did the best they could with the information that they had. Part of loving yourself, trusting yourself, is forgiving yourself. Forgiving yourself for doing the best you could with the information that you had. So as part of trying to give kids the feeling of loving themselves and trusting themselves and forgiving themselves is to make sure that the parents feel that as well. Because the perfect can't be the enemy of the good. And because we weren't perfect in every situation, we got to forgive ourselves for that. Again, that's just a general principle. We just beat ourselves up over and over and over again for things that just don't exist anymore, causing unnecessary traumas to ourselves and our kids because of that. Anyway. All right. So we get to kind of the meat, the substance maybe of what I want to talk about, which is how to develop an identity in a kid, essentially so they'll tell. Now, we look around at the Me Too movement. This is why I've said we're living in the Me Too movement and how to raise kids in the Me Too world, but that we've always been in a Me Too world. These kids did, and continue to suffer in silence. So how can we get to a place of telling? I think it starts by developing an identity in a kid. And it seems like a challenging thing to do, but maybe it's not. We complain, right? We look around, and when a kid comes out, when there's a disclosure or an outcry, we wonder, why didn't anybody listen to or believe that kid? I think I have an answer. It's because we don't listen to or believe our kids. So maybe that's the answer. Instead of start by believing, let's start by listening and believing our kids about the little stuff. Seems trite, right? Well, I think it starts with an identity. Some of the problems that I see, especially in kids that just don't tell, are the kids that are treated as simply extensions of a group, extensions of a parent, extensions of both parents, extensions of the family, extensions of the neighborhood, of the church, of the school, of the team, of whatever tribe you belong to. The more they're viewed as extensions of those different groups, and not as an entity into themselves. I think we suppress that identity. We suppress in them some of that self-confidence and that self-trust. The reason I'm pretty comfortable saying this is because I've had both the unfortunate and fortunate opportunity to talk to many, many, many dozens of kids as young as 4 years old about one of the worst things that have ever happened to them. One-on-one, where I'm just trying to listen to the child, navigate their own world, interpret their own world, and communicate their world. And what I learned is really inspiring. Kids, the littlest of kids, are damn good at it. These kids enter the world like a sponge, just wanting to navigate and interpret everything around them. Does that ring true to parents out here? I'm seeing nods here. Yeah? Isn't it fun to watch these kids explore, learn about their world, and do a good job of it? Too often we don't trust our kids. I think we don't trust our kids because we really don't trust ourselves. And that's why I say it comes from starting by trusting ourselves so that we can trust our kids. So as I've been talking to these kids, I talk to them with a very specific format. It's called a forensic interview. And I went to some training in how to conduct it, and it's going to sound, oh, forensic, that's really involved, right? That's like very sciencey and very law enforcement-y. Well, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about it. I think you'll find maybe it's just how we should talk to our kids and talk to other people all the time. Listen and believe. Have confidence in your kids that they can interpret their world very well and that they're eager to communicate their world to you. If we give them the confidence, the trust, and the opportunity to do it. All right, so some real, hopefully some practical examples of how to do that. Well, the way that I first try to present it is to talk about what the forensic interview is. The forensic interview is an interview meant to get a child talking, to get the child in what we call free recall, that they're in their memory and they're explaining everything they can about what they experienced. The way I first learned the technique was bringing some kids in. You hear about these techniques and you talk to a few kids. Now, here's just kind of an overview of this. And we're going to be talking about forensic interview a lot over the course of the next however many months, because this is just a taste. This is just a touch or just a little introduction into what this is. And so we're going to get into more details as we go on. But the forensic interview, the format is this: to have a kid-friendly environment. You don't go to a police station. You don't have them in a cold, stale room. But you have them in a room that's comfortable. They have art on the wall, chair, couch. Interviewer that's just sitting down and talking. You don't have a recorder out, so they don't know that they're being recorded, but they're being recorded. Video and audio. But they don't need to know that because they're just having a conversation. Conversation they'd probably rather not have, but a conversation they're going to have nonetheless. And again, what I've learned is if given the freedom and the framework, kids are willing to talk about really hard things. Sometimes we inject our own fears and our own insecurities on our kids, because they're extensions of the family, they're extensions of us, and we'd have a tough time talking about things. What hope do we have that our kids will? Well, it may just be that our kids are better than us. It may just be that our kids haven't been programmed as much as we have to not trust ourselves. It's a theory anyway. So you've got this atmosphere, and the forensic interview starts by just talking about neutral topics, right? Let's just talk about what you did today, talk about school, talk about things they like. You get to know about the kid. You do that for a number of reasons. One, you're getting a language sample. I want to know how verbal this kid is. I want to know what their vocabulary's like. And so you're getting a sample there. The other thing you're doing, then you get into the meat of it. You start talking about things that happen, things that they experienced. And what you're doing is you're starting very broad. Get the kid talking. Just tell me about something. And they get going for a little while. You let them go. You don't interrupt them. Just let them go. And then redirect them. Come narrow. Get to a specific, maybe something you really want to get more details about by asking a direct question. Never a leading question, and never introducing information, and never using words, terminology, vocabulary that doesn't belong to the kid. That's a general framework for how the kids are talked to, and when they're free to do that, and they have somebody that's just taking in information, man, they'll give you a wealth of information. So let's go through that a little bit and explain kind of how it works. The kids that I brought in in the first time that I was trained, they went to fire station. Went to see some firemen and everything. You know, one of those tours that the schools do at a fire station. And we were there to learn about their experience in the fire station. Okay, so. Place to start? I don't have to be the only one talking. How would you start a conversation like that with a kid if you want to know about their experience at the fire station? You're a teacher. Kristen, how would you ask that?
Maybe where did you go somewhere today? Where did you go today?
Yeah. Tell me about something that happened today. Love that question for a number of reasons. You've not injected any information. A lot of times, when somebody first goes into that situation, they'll ask, "Tell me what you did at the fire station." Okay, based on what I've said before, what's wrong with that? Maybe not wrong. What's less than great about that? No creeds, right? Any thoughts?
They didn't do anything.
Yeah, you've just provided information. I know you were at the fire station. We're going to talk about that. You've now closed yourself off to a lot of what that kid may have to tell you about their world. What'd you do today? Well, had my favorite cereal, Captain Crunch, and then, you know, kids will do what they do. Fantastic. You're now getting a sense for how this child's mind works. Moves, tracks. Let them go. Let's apply that to our kids. How was school today? Right? Maybe we could broaden that out. I try to ask kids, my nieces and nephews, how'd you spend your time when you're not in school? I don't want to talk about school. I want to know what they're interested in. Especially my nieces and nephews, I don't really, get to talk to as often. That's my way of finding out, are they in volleyball? Are they in, band, something else? How do you spend your time when you're not in school? The next question that I love, whatever they answer, tell me about that. Tell me about that is a fantastic tool. It's a fantastic question that's underused when we talk to our kids. Tell me about that. Not a direct question, not a one word answer. It doesn't call for a one word answer. It forces the kid to talk a little bit. Tell me about that. Let them go. I'll just sit and wait. And if they're talking about a sequence, one of my other favorite questions is, what happened next? And let them go. Okay? That's a quick example of of kind of the forensic interviewing format. Now, they may get to a place, and let me go to the fire station example. At some point, the kids are talking about the fire station, talking about what they saw. So now you can ask them, what are some of the things you did when you were there? Okay? A lot of people say, well, that's a very specific question. That's okay. I'm redirecting. But it's broad. It's a direct. It's broad enough to get information. I'm not introducing information. Well, I saw the trucks. We got to see the pole. Got to see where they eat. And I got to see where they sleep. Okay? Tell me about that. There's a lot they said there, right? Tell me about that. Well, they might talk about a little bit more, give you more detail about all those things. Again, you're getting information, having a conversation, listening, and believing. Okay. When we were doing this training, one of the things that we didn't know is that at some point during the meeting or during the walkthrough, the field trip, someone in a kind of animal costume, like a mascot, that's it, thank you, came in there and was around there. And that was what we were trying to get to. With all the stimulus, all the information of what this kid experienced at the fire station, we wanted to get out about this mascot. And that was, in some cases, challenging, because some of these kids just didn't care about the mascot. It wasn't in their mind. We didn't know about it. But the point is, can you ask questions in a roundabout way, in a broad enough way to get the kid talking about their experience and about their life so they eventually talk about the mascot? And now you can go further, right? Well, there was this whatever, you know, animal. Follow-up questions, what?
Tell me about that.
Well, he just walked in, he did this, he did jumping jacks, he did a cartwheel, he did absolutely nothing, he was ugly, I hated him. I hated him. Tell me about that. Now the child's talking about their feelings, interpreting their world. Is there any question, if you get that type of a description, these kids went to the fire station, this person in a suit came in there. Yeah, the person in a suit, right? So these are just some strategies I suggest in just talking to your kids. When I first got this training, I realized, man, I don't really talk to my kids. I ask them very specific questions. What'd you do today? Did you have fun? Did you like it? Good. Leave. Right? How often do we stay on the surface with our kids? Let's talk a little bit more about being an extension of the family, because I jump. See, this is the problem with notes. They don't flow the way I just flow where my mind goes. But before I got into communication, but we already covered that, I did want to talk about kids being their own entity as it relates to their own body. Let kids be in charge of their own body. What's that look like? For me, that says don't force kids to touch another person they don't want to touch, or be touched if they don't want to be touched. Easy, right? But what about when grandma comes in and grandma hasn't been around for a few months? And my 3-year-old, 5-year-old, 12-year-old, 16-year-old just in a freaking mood. And they just don't want to hug grandma. What's the response? Go touch grandma. Go hug grandma. Go give grandma a kiss. Go give grandma a kiss. Go give grandpa a kiss. Go grab, right? Sit on his lap. It's okay. Let the kids be in charge of their own bodies. I'm not much of a huggy guy. I'm becoming more of a huggy guy. But there's just sometimes I just don't want to touch people or be touched. You ever experienced that? No, go hug them. Go touch them. Go do, right? Same with the kids. Let them be temperamental too. One of the techniques I started using years ago was to invite kids to come to me. High fives, fist bumps. Eventually get to a point where they're comfortable enough to hug me. You know, and I'm talking about the kids in my life, right? Talking about, in some cases, my own kids. They don't want to be touched. They don't want to be cuddled in that moment because of whatever reason. Sometimes I do it anyway, but I try not to. But especially the kids that I don't know very well or I'm not around very well, I'll invite them. Come here, give me a high five. They don't want to. Give them a high five. Give them a high five. My response to that is always not to the parent, but to the kid. You never have to give me a high five if you don't want to. And sometimes I'll even go further. You never have to give anyone a high five if you don't want to. Not my job, but I'm trying to give that child their own identity, power over their own body. Does that seem something that's just ridiculous to anyone? Does anyone want to push back on that? Is it something you think you could apply and explain to another adult? Oh, I'm sorry. Especially when they say, no, come here. We don't make our kids touch or be touched if they don't want to. Reinforce that. Emphasize that to friends, family, other people. Like my friend Katniss say, it'll catch fire or something like that. That's a book, right? Katniss, Catching Fire. Goes with that same, and I'm going to go a step further. Don't hit your freaking kids. Creed's dogma, right? On this one, just don't hit your freaking kids. I'm just going to say it's a hard, fast rule. Just don't hit your freaking kids. Just don't hit your kids. Let them be in charge of their own bodies. Let them decide who to touch and not touch. It gives them power. It gives them confidence. And it helps them to trust themselves and love themselves. These kids are so freaking good at navigating their own world and knowing what they want. And in most cases, why? If we give them a chance to explain it. Right? Extension of a parent's other way. This is controversial, right? We're a basketball family. You will play basketball. Is that taking away their identity? Is that making them an extension of the family? Maybe they just don't want to. It's a tough thing to do. We're battling against just years and years and years of conditioning. But I think that's another way to make them develop their own identity, to trust themselves, to love themselves. You give a child power over their own body. You give a child the opportunity to communicate their real world to you on the small things. You give the child to articulate what they want to do as their own little identity. These are principles, right? I'm not talking about sexual abuse yet, am I? Not even at all. Do you see the application? Does it make sense? Am I just full of crap? I might be. Again, I'm not a prophet. I don't know. I might be completely full of crap on this. But if it rings true to you, if it's something that makes sense, take it, steal it, apply it. Extension of the family, extension of the coach, extension of the team. Thinking about instances where the kids have come home, I'm frustrated, I'm dealing with my own stuff, I'm in my head. How was practice? It sucked. Yeah, suck it up. Practice is just going to suck sometimes, okay? Sure, that's a true statement, but wait a minute. Tell me about that. Not why does practice suck, why? Tell me about that. Well, coach was on me, blah, blah, blah. What happened? Now you're in the game. Now you're talking. Now you're finding out about their world. Now you may get to the point as, yeah, well, suck it up. Sometimes that happens, just deal with it. But now you have the right information in order to do that. So it's easy for me now to say this stuff as my kids have gotten older, but, you know, I'm not just in the middle of little kids and just trying to deal with stuff. But, you know, too often I perceived that I just knew things my kids didn't. And that's true. As parents, we just do. But one of the things I don't think I appreciated as much is my child's perception, that they might actually have information that I don't. You ever been in the other room, your kids arguing or having an issue with either their sibling or someone else, and you come barreling in, blah, 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 let's fix this, this is what's going on, you're at fault. You had a perception in the other room, think you understand a lot about what's going on, but really that kid knows more than you do. To take a minute to let the kid give you their interpretation, interpret their world, communicate their world. It gives them power. It gives them confidence, and it reinforces that you're listening, you're believing, and you trust them. We're not talking about sexual abuse yet, are we? But do you see maybe how this forensic interview, this wooey forensic interviewing isn't woo? Listen and believe our kids. That empowers them. That gives them that identity. Now, I'm not saying that being a part of a team, a school, a neighborhood, a church, a family is a bad thing. Remember one of my creeds earlier, one of my philosophies, be connected. That's part of that. But I think the healthiest kids that are in those situations, in those tribes, in those communities, are the ones that have a robust and healthy identity. Confidence in themselves and the willingness to talk about their world. My kid doesn't do that. My kid just doesn't have that personality. I've talked to a lot of kids. I've talked to the shy ones. I've talked to the insecure ones. I mean, I've talked to the rambunctious ones, the aggressive ones, class clowns. You name it. The personality, I've talked to them, and I've learned that personality is less critical than the environment we foster. I don't know, it's just an idea. All right. That's really all I got on developing an identity. Maybe applying some tiny little techniques and strategies that I learned as a forensic interviewer that I think might be pretty easy to apply. And not just your kids, but maybe to other people. Now, I'll tell you about a personal experience. The kid that I interact with, asking them these questions, and ask them about school. I hate it. Tell me about that. I really hate math. Now, my memory was you were really good at math. Did I get that right? Yeah, I like math. I just hate math class. Tell me about that. I was a reluctant kid. I was picking up on something. Now I'm in my mode, right? All right. Let's see if maybe there's something here. Just asking questions, talking about their life. We stumbled on some concerning things that were happening between the teacher and another student. It was making my friend's kid uncomfortable. She told me, I'm uncomfortable when he says these things and that things to this other girl. Got a little bit of information, and they were troubling things. So I took action, made some calls, got involved, Got police involved. Turns out that math teacher had a real problem. Got fired. Because I asked my friend's kid, tell me about math. Well, tell me about school. Now, it's not to say, oh, yay, math's so great. That's not it. I was just, certainly wasn't trying to get a disclosure. I was just trying to learn about this kid's life. Try to learn about your kid's life. Help them navigate, interpret, and communicate their world. Do that. And I think that's a long way towards developing a strong identity in a kid. We're not talking about sexual abuse. We're not talking about disclosures. We're not talking about these things. We're talking about giving ourselves, giving these kids confidence to love themselves, trust themselves, to tell you about their world. All right, that's it. That's about 45 minutes, just over an hour. We'll be back in two Wednesdays to continue the conversation.
Wait, you're not going to take questions?
Oh, I can. Questions, yeah. If anyone has questions, happy to...
Why are you being so mean to the way that I parented my kid? I did everything wrong.
Yes.
I'm sitting there going, oh, shit.
Yes. Oh, Glenn, you and me both, my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. In fact, I just had a conversation with my son, Tommy, this weekend. And... Huh? I don't care. And I was thinking about this thing about being an extension of the family, and I had this, oh my goodness. I called him up and I said, Tommy, I apologize that I tried to direct you in a certain way of what you want to do in life. And essentially what I tried to do is convince him to not do a certain major. Right? And it was a major in music, and I was projecting my own insecurities, my own self-doubt, and saying, you should do something really practical. So I called him up and I apologized for that. And I said, I was trying to inject my own fears and concerns and my own issues onto you. I want you to do what you want to do. And I want you to explore the things you want to do. And just because I told you that before, I want you to reject all that and follow your heart. It sounds so trite. It sounds so freaking cliche. But yeah. So yeah, Glenn, you and me both, homie. But all I can do is move forward and try to continue to use these tools to my kids. Catch fire. I don't know. Any other questions? Lots of stuff here. I'm going to hit one more point since we're in the forensic interviewing. Is one of the things that I always do when I talk to kids is when you give options, to give a third option. So... did you like it, dislike it, or something else? I always do the something else because it might be, okay? Another technique quick because I want to do practical techniques as well. I hate asking kids about what their favorite anything is. What's your favorite flavor? What's your favorite movie? What's your favorite book? What's your favorite subject in school? I hate that question. What's something you like? The reason why is, now I'm lecturing, I would ask the question, why? Try application here. But the reason why is because you just introduced information. And some kids may not have a favorite. And now you have forced a false selection on them. Oh my goodness, I don't have a favorite, but maybe I should have a favorite. What is a favorite? What is my favorite? Oh, and now you've just created anxiety for a kid who about what their favorite popsicle flavor is. Maybe they don't have a favorite. Now ask them, what's a flavor you like? If they have a favorite, are they going to be shy about telling you? Hell no. Grape's my favorite, right? Grape, always grape. But now you've just gotten more information. Tell me about something. Tell me about a flavor you like. Grape. Grape's my favorite. I like grape the most in this. But in cherry, but this, I like cherry. You know, I think I'm doing a Brian Regan bit at this point. But but really, that's a... Anyway, does the example make sense? Is that... now you've gotten new information. Now you understand this child's world. This child happens to like grape, and it's favorite when it comes to the popsicle, but when it comes to soda, they like cherry soda or cola, you know. You've just now learned so much more about that child's information, and they've expressed it pretty clearly, and now you have confidence. Well, if you've given that child some confidence, let them know that you're someone who will listen and believe them. You've supported that identity of whatever, cherry, grape, flavor, music. So I hate those questions are something to think about. Never inject information, unnecessary information, and give them all types of options. Do you like it, dislike it, or something else? Because maybe it's something else. I just don't care. That's valuable information, and it teaches you a lot about a kid. But if even with an adult, if you force them to make a selection, you're probably going to do one. If you don't, you might get more information about that kid's world. Thank you for your time. We'll be back in 2 Wednesdays on a new topic.
And next Wednesday, we'll be reading from the new Book of Mormon that I'm writing.
Yes.
Shadow of the Lamanites.
I like it.
Now we're not recording. If you guys want to have, if anyone wants to have questions or a conversation that's not being recorded.
Hi, my name's Chalice from Clearfield, Utah, and I like listening to Infants on Thrones while shopping at Deseret Industries. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones. Infants on Thrones.
All right, talk.
Talk. Sibilance.
Sibilance.
That's my go-to. That's all I know. Just in the back, is that, or
yeah,
what do you?
Yeah, have to make sure that you don't.
Yeah, let me do this.
You can put it in your front pocket if there's room up there.
Yeah. Plenty of room, Glenn.